you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and it's that time again, the Halloween season, and that means my guest is, of course, the host of It's Midnight here on the network, Ryan Daly. Hi, Ryan.
Ooh, happy Halloween.
What's going on? Who's here? This is the ghost of Ryan Daly. What's happening? Yes, of course, last year Ryan was here and we did the House of Mystery Treasury Edition. So now it's Halloween 2018. We're here to talk about the Ghosts Treasury Edition because, of course, DC had the long-running Ghosts series. This book, Ryan, did you have this one or is this like a recent edition or what?
Ooh, no, I'm going to do this every time.
that's not going to get old fast.
Yeah. I got this one the same time I got the House of Mystery Treasury. When the idea came to me to do It's Midnight, I just decided, okay, I'm going to look for all the best of collections of these horror things. So I got the Treasuries and I got the Digests. So yeah, I've had this for a couple of years now.
Okay, cool. It's a really good collection. It was on sale. It's limited collector's edition, I should mention, number C32. It was on sale September 5th, 1974. It features a very nice cover, as if they're any other kind, by Nick Carty of two, I guess they're kids? It's kind of hard to tell. Like, they're teens, and they're entering in a door, and it says, spiked to the door, it says $1,000 reward to anyone who dares stay one night in this haunted house, and it's cobwebs, and of course on the inside is a big spectral skeleton guy with a... He's sort of a proto-Skeletor about to grab our two presumed ghost adventurers here. Like with everything with Nick Carty, I think it's beautifully composed. I love all the black, and it's just the light popping in through the door. It's scary, but it's also a little kid-friendly. Like, you could have seen this on a children's book of scary tales. I mean, it's nothing
too
crazy. It's not Neil Adams or Bernie Wrightson, which would drive kids into, like, wetting themselves. This is a little more genteel than that.
Right. It's a cover that says, like, spooky fun. Like, are you afraid of the dark type of thing? It's exactly that thing. It's we're going to be dealing with ghosts and haunted houses and stuff like that, but it's not like serial murderer stuff. Like, you know, there's enough color to it and vibrancy that it has that kind of that feel that this will be appropriate for, you know, somewhat young readers.
At no point was DC going to adapt the Texas Chainsaw Massacre into a comic book format.
The skeleton guy thinks he grabs them, and then the girl turns out to be Freddy Krueger. She ripped her face off. And
oh, switcheroo! Oh, my God. Yeah, on the cover it says, we challenge you to read these true tales of the supernatural. So, Ryan, are you up to the challenge, do you think?
You know, I got the time, so sure.
All right, we'll give it a shot. Be forewarned, everybody. We are going to kind of zip through these stories because there are approximately 117 stories in this book, and they're all written by Leo Dorfman. So
yes. This is
no creator in the history of DC Treasuries got his own treasury, like a theme, like Neil Adams did get a treasury, but this is kind of like the unofficial Leo Dorfman Treasury Edition.
I looked that up, and apparently, like, he pitched this Ghosts anthology and wrote every story in the first issue, and the editor of Ghosts issue 1, I think it was Murray Boltonoff, was like, okay, it's going to look bad if you write every story. So he just had him change his name on some of the stories.
Leo Dorfman.
Well, it was like Leo Dorfman, like Jeff Jones, like David George or something like that. He just kind of like made up these other names and everything, but it was all the same guy, but he just didn't want to piss off other people. So he made it look like there were like three or four contributors. But yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
There are a lot of stories in this, and as is the case with a lot of ghost stories, they're fairly repetitive.
Yeah, a little bit. As I was doing the notes and I'm like, you know, writing down all the credits, and I'm like, oh, this one's by Leo Dorfman. Okay. This one, also by Leo Dorfman. Tick, 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 tick. Leo Dorfman. Like, my God, this guy was paid by the pound, I guess. Just,
yes.
He had, like, a boat payment or something. He was just like, I'm just going to write as many spooky stories as DC will take. So on the inside cover is the table of contents. As we see, there's a lot of stories in here. And then there's a little black and white image of, I guess, some just sort of, I don't know if it's supposed to be a bunch of guys as a, or one guy in kind of a spooky line. He's holding a candle. I'm not sure what's going on there. The first story is a specter poured the potion. It's from Ghost Number 6, as I said, written by Leo Dorfman and art by Art Saff. A miserly apothecary fires his long-suffering assistant when the assistant gives medicine away to a sick old woman. The assistant dies of a heart attack from the stress, much to the delight of the apothecary. But that night, people in the town see the assistant, who now casts no shadow. A woman arrives looking for medicine for her sick mother. The assistant mixes the correct ingredients and asks no money. The woman faints when the assistant disappears as if a ghost. She collects the mixture and brings it to her mother, who was saved from death. The doctor scoffs at the woman's story, but when the apothecary returns to his pharmacy, he sees it is empty and cobweb-strewn as if a tomb. According to legend, the shock of this turned the apothecary into a mindless, mute vegetable for the rest of his life. So, Ryan, what did you think of this one?
I like the art by Artie Saff. I think his art is probably the strongest thing in the story. I didn't necessarily think this was the strongest story to open the whole treasury with.
I agree.
But I really like the opening splash page. I think that's maybe why this was chosen. And to like frame it, you get the opening shot of the old apothecary kicking his assistant out, firing him or whatever like that. That image is all framed like in the glass of the goblet or whatever. And we see this kind of demonic form or like a devil or something holding the goblet with his red demon face in the background and his claws up front holding the thing. It's a really cool arresting image. So maybe just they wanted that because it was going to be the first image. But other than that, the story's fine. It's cool. I'm not sure that it's good enough to be the lead story of the whole treasury.
Yeah, it has moments that you have to kind of blow by where it's like, okay, the woman comes and she asks for the medicine, and then the assistant mixes it, and then he turns into a ghost and disappears, and then she faints, and she manages to like put everything back in the test tubes in the exact proportion. Like it goes by so fast, it papers over a lot of a wait, what? Like, why is this happening? I agree. I like the art by Art Saff, and I love that last panel of the apothecary just staring off into space like a vegetable. Like, that's a really well done drawing. So, and then, yeah. You know, it's funny, these guys were not like, I mean, they did some superhero stuff, but they were mostly good at drawing real people. And this stuff looks like it, you know, they're all in their like sort of period detail. It all looks very good. And you're right, the splash page is very good. So yeah, the story, but I like the art a lot.
There's a weird bit of logic where the older man, he's telling her, he's making the case that no, she went there, she fainted and knocked into the glass or whatever, and she just accidentally put all of the potion ingredients together or whatever. She's like, wait, that doesn't make any sense, but that is actually what happened.
Right,
she saw the ghost. She did faint, she did knock over all the things, and then just happened to put all of the ingredients back in the right order. So he's making the case that there is no ghost, but like it still ended up being the same way. Like,
yeah. Right, yeah, it's just like, okay, you just blow it by. So, yeah, I agree. I think they probably love that splash page so much, and it seemed like a good way to open it. Now, if you want to talk about a story that I think was the good way to open it, it's the next story, which is Death's Bridegroom from Ghost Number 1 by, once again, Leo Dorfman and Gemma Pero. In London in 1965, a woman is about to be married, but she has killed herself. The note left behind says that her groom-to-be stole all her money and skipped town. The police vow to be on the lookout for this third-rate actor from the States, Ron Tracy. Ron and his friend Cy are headed away from the scene of the crime when a mysterious fog envelops them. They find a large mansion and stop to ask directions. Inside are all the trappings for a bridal feast, but no one is inside enjoying it. A butler answers and tells the two men to get lost, but a woman named Sharon Dean demands they be let in. She offers to let them stay the night. Cy is scared, but Ron thinks there's a chance for another scam, so he agrees. The butler tells Cy the story that Sharon was stood up by her groom-to-be, and the wound was so great that she ordered the dining room sealed up, left everything inside untouched. Ron notices he looks eerily similar to the man, thanks to a painting of him still hanging on the wall, and dreams up a scam. He lays on the charm to Sharon and returns to the mansion several times in a week, ending with a proposal. Sharon agrees. At the wedding, Cy gets freaked out at all the guests, all of whom dress like it's decades ago and drive old cars. He goes to find the police and is told no one has lived in the Dean estate for years. They find the Dean house, except it is now all ruins. Sai finds a wedding cake topper that he saw at the ceremony. The police think Sai has gone mad and drag him away, and as we see the ghostly images of Ron and his skeletal Sharon hand in hand. Ryan, what did you think of this one, Ryan?
So you mentioned that this one could have been the front. This was the first story in the first issue of Ghosts.
There you go.
This one definitely could have been the leadoff. And the first image by Aparo, the way this leads, it's such a good image of the groom freaking out as a skeletal bride is grabbing him. You see the cake, very, very detailed. And everything, but covered in cobwebs and all of these, like, skeletal, spooky hands holding up, like, glasses of champagne and wine to give them cheers and everything. It's a really cool opening image. I wish this one had been up front. My only critique with it is that first image, that's, like, the climax of the story, and we don't get it at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we don't get the shock moment at the end.
They look kind of happy at the end, yeah.
Yeah. And at the end, because we don't see anything of the wedding, we just see Sai running away from the party to try and he gets the police and he comes back and everything's gone and presumably Ron is dead. He's been taken away, by his ghost bride or something like that. Well, what we don't see is what is in the very first image, but, that's the moment that would be the scare, the shock moment as a ghost story, but it's kind of reverse order. It's out of order, so it doesn't have that effect, but it's still – I mean, it's a Jim Aparo story, so it's great.
Yeah, I mean, Aparo was so – I mean, look, I don't have to go on and on about Aparo. Yeah. I already have. Everybody knows he's my favorite comic book artist of all time. But he so excelled at drawing, crooks and shysters and gangsters and guys with pencil-thin mustaches who I imagine all talked yeah, you know, they all had that kind of thing. And so this guy, the Ron, is such a weasel, no pun intended, he's just immediately – he meets a woman and 5 minutes later he's working an angle. You know, he's just unrepentant scumbag. And you're just waiting for him to get his comeuppance. And I'm imagining, like you said, you don't see it at the end because in the end they look kind of happy together. But I'm imagining it's kind of 2 seconds later. It's like that scene in Raiders where all the angels turn into it becomes there's the whammy there.
Right, his face melts off. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. I think this is just really fun. And again, Paro is great at these details and the characterizations of everybody. I mean, it's just beautiful. And eventually DC, I think, stopped giving him this stuff because they realized they could make a lot more money putting him on Batman and these other high profile things. But he was still doing in the early 70s these little bit pieces here and there. And so he's just terrific. And so to me, the setup for this one,
yeah, the premise of this one reminded me of one of his Spectre stories from Adventure Comics. This is the type of character who would have been hunted by the Spectre for driving this woman to her death.
Yeah. The last word balloon is Sai as he's just laughing maniacally, which is
yeah,
touch.
Of course, yeah. My only other note, it's on page 12 of the Treasury. It's page 6 of the actual short story. The last panel on that, it's Ron and the girl kissing Sharon. He says, "Sharon, I can't hide it any longer. I love you. I want to marry you." She says, "Oh, David, I mean Ron, you don't know how long I've waited, how much I've wanted you to ask me." I want to take that panel and just put it in one of those comics out of context, tweets or something like that. The fact that they're these two people just kissing and professing their love, but she gets his name wrong. And I just think, out of context from the story, that would be a little funny.
I would imagine this story could have fit relatively well in the Gothic romance comics that DC was doing, which, of course, is what we're celebrating all this month, the dark podcast, the Forbidden Love theme that's wafting through all the different episodes, all the different shows on the network this month. But, I mean, it's got enough of a romance angle that I think you probably could have put it in one of those books and it would have passed muster. It's a really, really solid story. It's very, very fun. I like it. And it's also cool to see it in modern day. Most ghost stories are kind of old timey and they take place many years ago, but this is 1965 and this is relatively contemporary. So that's really cool.
So The Dark Goddess of Doom with art by John Kalman starts off with a car crash as basically a hired thug who was assigned to rob this giant statue of the Hindu goddess Kali. He somehow dies behind the wheel and crashes. The guy he was working for, this guy named Christopher Morton, takes the statue, leaves his hired guy just to be dead behind the wheel. The cops investigate, and they find that the driver was seemingly strangled to death somehow behind the wheel. But how did that happen? Anyway, they have this sort of psychic Swami guy kind of tell them that the statue is cursed. Anyway, we go back to this museum where Chris Morton is passing off the statue, trying to bilk people out of their money for it. And then one night the power goes out and the people in the museum hear the sounds of a commotion, and it seems that the statue has come alive and is stomping down the halls, eventually finds Morton and murders him. And yeah.
That's pretty much it, yeah. Yeah, I thought the story was okay. I'm like John Callan to me. That stuff is mm-hmm. – his work is pretty kind of dull. And this story is, to me, so thoroughly unmysterious that it doesn't really work. I think the best panel is the inset one on the last page where it's him after he's been strangled and his corpse is all mangled. Like, that looks really terrific. But otherwise, it's like I wish maybe they had given it to somebody with just a little more grit, because I don't want to say it's like coloring book level, because it's not that simple, but it's, I don't know, it's just, there's something about it, he just undercuts the horror of it. I like the statue, the Kali statue with all the arms. Like, that's, and it actually sort of is narrating the story at the end. It's staring right at you. Gentlemen, it was a hate or vengeance. Gaze upon the betrothal ring the goddess wears. Could it be that it was love that made Kali embrace her victim? You know, like, that's a great image, but I don't know, art wise, I'm just kind of like, eh, you know, it's fine.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Like, the last page is pretty cool when you see him, like, screaming for help as she's coming after him with all six of her arms. And then, yeah, that inset panel of just him, and they describe him as being crushed to death as if by a giant vice. Like, this, like, bronze, like, statue is just, like, just crushing him with, like, six limbs and the horror on his face. That's really cool. But other than that, yeah.
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah. A better story, I think, is the one that comes after this one, which is Death the Pale Horseman. It's, of course, written by our friend Leo, art by Artie Saff again. This is from Ghosts issue 5. It's 1939, and the army of Imperial Japan has invaded China. Colonel Ito Tanaka orders the Chinese prisoners to carry the spoils so his troops can move faster. Lieutenant Saburo protests the cruel treatment and is thus reprimanded for questioning his superior. Later, Tanaka's troops come upon the tomb of Prince Timju, a Mongol warrior who conquered the land for Genghis Khan. Tanaka believes Timju was buried with treasure and orders the tomb looted. Once again, Saburo protests, citing grave robbing as an affront to his honor. Go figure. Tanaka has Saburo arrested and breaks into the tomb himself. There he discovers the traditional weaponry and armor of a Mongol warrior, but the only thing of value is an ivory carving of a Mongolian on horseback with bow and arrow drawn. An old scholar catches Tanaka stealing the carving and says that this act will release the spirit demon of Timju. Tanaka draws his sidearm and shoots the scholar to shut him up. That night, before Tanaka's men can lay siege to the next Chinese village, the army is ambushed by ghosts on horseback. Tanaka's men flee from what Saburo recognizes as the Golden Horde of Prince Timju. Tanaka runs off alone into the hills, still clutching the ivory carving, hoping to sell it for a fortune. But a ghostly rider chases him down, draws back its bow, and fires an arrow into Tanaka's back, killing him. As the sun rises and the army regroups, Lieutenant Saburo notes that Colonel Tanaka is the only fatality. Also, the carving of the horseman looks just like the ghost warrior who killed the colonel. Also, the ivory horseman holds a bow, but there is no longer an arrow with it. The carving is returned to the tomb, but no one can explain Tanaka's death, not unless you believe in ghosts. So, what'd you think of this?
I liked it, and part of the reason, I think by the main reason I liked it, is because it's just such an unusual setting. You know, 1939 in the mountains of Asia, like, you, no haunted houses or anything. Like, it's just a very unusual place to set your ghost story. So I actually enjoyed it quite a bit. I thought it was interesting. I liked the idea of the totem, and like the totem's missing the arrow. Like, that was cool. So yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I do too. And I like when ghost stories kind of take on unusual settings, like war settings, like, you know, when especially when you see so much death and so much history on battlefields, when you can interpret ghost stories and bring them into that sort of realm. I think there's a lot of fodder for good storytelling there. So I think it was really cool that they explored that with this one. Artie Saf's art is really, really good. I like the page 7 of this story. It's 33 of the Treasury, when we see the rider coming after Colonel Tanaka and drawing back the arrow, and the look of pain as he's being shot as the arrow is going into his back. It's kind of cool. There's like an image of he's being shot in the background, and just in the foreground, you see him dropping the ivory carving, and you see that it no longer has the arrow, but it's still drawn back as if it just fired. So it's kind of this sort of reversal image where you see the thing in the foreground like almost fired the arrow that came back around and killed him. Yeah. So I just like the sort of composure of that.
Yeah, it was interesting. You said it's Leo Dorfman.
The composition of
it. Yeah, I mean, Dorfman was cranking these stories out. So, I mean, I guess sometimes you get a winner, sometimes you don't. But he probably had to do a little bit of history reading to like look this up and just get the details right. So same thing with Art Saf, too. So, yeah, not bad.
I'm sure that, yeah, he was probably reading like ghost stories from around the world to feed.
Right,
to
yeah,
feed
fodder. Them. Yeah, exactly. He's got to crank these things out. So the next thing is a one-page bonus feature for the Treasury, which is a Midnight Maze. And unfortunately, there's nothing really spooky about this Midnight Maze. It's just a maze. There's nothing really in it about it that's necessarily remarkable. There's no monsters or anything like that to get to the end of it or whatever. I mean, it was done by Bob Rozakis, so it's just a little, you know, the whole idea is that it's a race, because it says grab a friend and two pencils and ruin your comic book. So that's the Midnight Maze little bonus feature. So then we have yet another story.
All right, The Spectral Coachman, written by, who knows, art by Tony DeZuniga. This is also from Ghosts issue 1. One night in 1956, a prospector named Johnny Cass, not Chris Franklin, calm down, Johnny Cass, is driving his Jeep in the mountains north of Tombstone, Arizona, when he sees a ghostly image of Rafe Brady driving a stagecoach and firing his rifle to ward off the road agents who attacked him nearly 100 years ago. The next day, Johnny tells the townspeople what he saw. They don't believe him. Rafe Brady's old stagecoach has been locked up in the stables for decades. And of course, Johnny couldn't have seen an actual ghost because ghosts don't exist, duh. So yeah, Johnny Cass is totally lying or crazy. A few nights later, Johnny's out driving when his Jeep breaks down. He starts to walk back to town when he's set upon by a pack of hungry wolves. The wolves surround Johnny and are about to have him for dinner when the phantom stagecoach rides by. Rafe Brady's ghost shoots his rifle, killing two of the wolves and sending the rest of the pack scattering. The ghost then invites Johnny into the coach and takes him to within sight of the town before the spectral coach vanishes. The next day, the locals are no more eager to believe Johnny's story, but they can't explain what appear to be tracks coming from the stable where the old stagecoach is locked up. Johnny and some of the others return to the spot where Brady's ghost saved him, and sure enough, they find two dead wolves. They also find the shell casings of bullets belonging to the kind of rifle that Rafe used but haven't been used in modern weapons for decades. The locals are perplexed. The only explanation could be ghosts.
Even though the guy in the last panel says, there's no such thing as ghosts. Ah, ha, 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 ha. He's laughing there at the end. Yeah, I like this one a lot. Again, really the artwork. Tony DeZuniga. He was one of those guys I didn't like as a kid. I just was like, it's too scratchy. It's too weird. And now I really like it. And again, setting again, another usual place for a ghost story, like out in the West. It's yeah, I mean, you have to expect Jeb Stuart to appear at some point. But I like this one a lot. I mean, I wish they didn't end every story with the little blurb. Now do you believe in ghosts? Like, stop hitting me over the head. I already bought the comic book. I mean, just give me a break.
And this isn't the story that's going to convince you. But it's a good story. I do like the art. I think Tony DeZuniga was really good at these types of genre stories, particularly like horror or like Western, things like that. It's cool. I like the setting. I really like how he has the wolves attacking. But other than that, it's as we're going through these stories, folks, you're going to see a lot of repetition. We're going to say a lot of the same things. But
hard to believe when they were all written by the same guy. Some repetition. So, all right, we'll move right on. And the next one is The Crimson Claw, which, of course, Ryan, you were very familiar with. It's Ghost number 4 by Dio Lorfman and George Tuska. It's a baby is born with a deformed demonic claw, and as he grows up, he's told by a fortune teller that it means he will go down in history and die young. We see that is true when we learn that the man is John Wilkes Booth. First of all, this story is so fast. It is, what, like 4 pages, I think?
Yeah.
4 pages? Now, of course, Ryan and Scott X did a great job covering the story over on It's Midnight. So we are basically going to outsource the coverage of this story to that show, because Scott X, as everybody knows, is a fantastic podcast guest, and he is big on Lincoln. He knows a lot about that stuff. So you and Scott did a great job. So I would say everybody – I thought it was fine. I like George Tuska. It's an interesting story. I don't get the connection, really, between, like, the hand and John Wilkes Booth. Like, it's – I don't see – like, I don't get it. Like, why are they connected? But it's a nice whammy ending that is like, oh, the bad guy is John Wilkes Booth. Of course, he's going to be famous. So I can see why it was in here. It's only 4 pages, and it fills up some space. But everybody, if you want to hear extended coverage, go to It's Midnight.
Yeah, episode 8 of Midnight, the podcasting hour. And yeah, Scott pitched this one to me, and he sold it because he is an expert in this area. And it's the story's fine, but listening to his coverage of it is really, really good. So check that out. Episode 8 of Midnight, the podcasting hour.
Yeah. Next up, there are two, again, these little short features. There's one called Famous and Infamous Ghosts, and drawn by E.R. Cruz or Ernie Cruz. And then there's Screams of the Ghost Queen. And again, it's kind of like these – and then there's The Bloody Boots of Houndswood, which are, again, these are 1 or 2 page stories. And they're just like super quick little fun features. And then and then we have The White Ghost of Hohenzollerns. I don't have no idea if I'm saying that right, but that must have been a bitch to letter. And then that one is 2 pages, and that one actually I like a lot because it's got this spectral ghost woman at the end. It's set on World War I, and that looks very much like the ghost from Raiders, as I already mentioned.
Yeah, yeah.
That's got this nightmare.
Or what the ghost librarian looks like after she turns.
Right. Yeah, the ghost librarian, Ghostbusters. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. So. They're real fun little features. They're from various issues of Ghosts as well. So they're cool little. We're not going to bother doing the plots because it would take us longer to recite the plots than it would be just to read the little pages. But they're nice little extras.
All right. The next one is The Fanged Specters of Kinshoro, written by Dorf Lidlin, by Ernie Chan / Ernie Chua. This is from Ghost number 4. In 1934, the most feared man in the Tanganyika. Yeah. In 1934, the most feared man in the Tanganyika territory of Africa is the witch doctor Matimbu, who uses dark magic to extort money and services from the local villagers. When signs point to Matimbu's responsibility for the death of a water bearer, a white scientist named Dr. Harrison in Africa to study diseases caused by tsetse flies has the witch doctor arrested and imprisoned for 6 months. When Matimbu is released, Dr. Harrison finds himself terrorized by a pride of ghost lions. The ghost lions kill more of Harrison's assistants and wreak havoc on the scientific research station. One of Harrison's friends, Malwi, brings the white man to his uncle Kimboro, who is wise in the same kind of magic that Matimbu uses. That night, the ghost lions again attack the science station, but Kimboro uses his own magic to reverse the spell, sending the lions back to slaughter and feed on their master, Matimbu. The next day, Matimbu's body is found without any physical marks of trauma, only the tracks of lions around the corpse.
My favorite part of this story is that panel on the last page where the lions are tearing into the guy. Like, that's a great shot. And I almost feel like because they're ghost lions, it's a little bit of a cheat because of the next panel. He's like, no mark on the body, no tear in the clothes, but he's dead. And that's because it was a code-approved comic.
Right.
You know, if it had been EC or if it had been Eclipse, either a few years before this or even Warren, you would have seen the guy getting ripped into shreds, even though they're ghost lines. So it feels a little bit of a cheat because we have to be bloodless because it's a code-proof comic and we can't get anything too gory. But that image of the guy as he's getting pulled by all the lines, that's terrific. Great, shot by Ernie Chan.
Yeah, that was it. And I think my one note was it's nice to have the white man be the hero for once.
When are we going to get a break, Ryan? Really? So put upon in this world. Yeah. Next up, take a break from that. Next up is Death Awaits Me from Ghost Number 6 by Manly O'Dorf and Jerry Grandinetti. We're getting punchy here. A man traveling by train is being driven mad by a relentless drum beat that apparently only he can hear. Outside the window of the train car, he sees the ghostly image of the woman waiting for him at the end of the line. The renowned dancer is Zadora Duncan. But the image is weeping. Why? It then contorts into a skeleton saying, "Death is waiting." He becomes so unnerved, a doctor gives him a sedative so he can finish the journey. Finally, the train arrives, and waiting for the man is not Isadora Duncan, but her chauffeur. The chauffeur tells the man that Miss Duncan is dead, killed in a freak accident that happened just a few hours ago, at the exact same time the man was having his visions. What? What did you think of this one, Ryan?
You know, this one might actually be my favorite story in the whole bunch. I don't know why. I like this one. I like this setup. This feels like a ghost story that I heard when I was in kindergarten or something. Like, the man has his image and he thinks he's going to die, like, on his way to see his, like, betrothed or something. But when he gets there, he finds out that, no, she's the one who died, and he saw her ghost at the exact moment or something like that. Like, that seems like a very primordial kind of, like, fundamental type of ghost story plot. But I like the art, and I really like, gosh, the lettering in this one.
Oh.
Whoever had to letter this one, like, either they were being punished for something.
I think it's Grandinetti. I think Grandinetti did his own lettering, I think.
Yeah, maybe.
Because all of his stories look like this.
Oh, I guess, yeah. But, like, how many times is, like, thud, like the repetition of the words and the sound effects of the train and the drum beats, and you get the impression that it's kind of overwhelming, and you can see why this guy thinks he's going nuts because of the volume of text that's just bombarding this guy with these sound effects. But it, for me, I don't know, I think it kind of works.
Yeah, I'm much like Tony DeZuniga, even more so with Jerry Grandinetti. I hated Grandinetti stuff when I was a kid. Just hated it. It was ugly and cartoony and weird. I couldn't stand it. Now, love it. Absolutely love it. Nobody was better at conveying someone going mad than Jerry Grandinetti, because he used these layouts, and you talk about the lettering, where it feels like that these letters are just like pressing on your brain, and you're being like, he just was so good at people suffering from internal turmoil, inner torment. He was so good at that. Whether he did stuff at Warren that was like this, and he did a bunch of stuff for DC. I love the way this looks, and I actually think, unlike a lot of the other artists here, like, I actually think this works better at a Treasury size, because he sticks in so many little lines and little details that to see it bigger really helps. And the thing with Isadora Duncan, like, it seems kind of like, I feel like Leo Dorfman just having to read this in a book, that Isadora Duncan died in a very weird way, where she got, and it's from real life, the dancer, she got her scarf caught in a wheel well and was strangled to death. It was like one of the bizarro, weird ass deaths of all time. I feel like he just read that and he was like, I got to work that in. That's a weird detail. I got to put that in the story. But I really do like this one. Again, it is a very ghosty story. And again, Grandinetti really puts it across. Like I said, he's like Frank Robbins, and like I said, Tony DeZuniga and Rick Estrada, a lot of these guys who I just didn't like as a kid, and now I'm like, oh, this stuff's great. So I wish there had been more Grandinetti in this Treasury, because it's terrific.
Yeah, I did. I mean, it's hard to compare against like somebody like Aparo, but I think this is my favorite story in the lot.
Ah, cool. Yeah, it's a good one. Next up is another one of these little two-pagers. It's like from real history. It's the Diabolic Cult of Voodoo, again, drawn by Ernie Chan. This one's by Frank Redondo, who does a really terrific art job. Again, it's more about voodoo. There's this panel, it's on panel 3 of the first page, where the ghostly image of this guy is looming over the town, and he's like casting this green light, and it's eerie as hell. Redondo does a great job on these two pages. I wish he had done more than just this little thing. It's too bad. It goes by so fast. It's really, really sharp.
Yeah, no, it's terrific. Like the fangs and everything. And like, just like something like the offset of like the title, the Day About Cult of Voodoo, and how there's like the skull with the candle burning on it, and like just this like lizard kind of like like chameleon like thing just like perched on it, or like a dragon or something. It's just, it's really, really cool.
Yeah, I really like it. And again, there's another one pager called To Raise the Dead, where again, it's all these voodoo stuff, because like, voodoo is just so much easier to settle. Like, you're immediately in the world of weirdness when you got voodoo. Speaking of voodoo, I have the next story, which is Ghost Cargo from the Sky, from Ghost Number 6 by Richard Hughes. And Jack Sparling, I wonder if that was somebody's pseudonym. On the small Pacific island of Jammer, the natives are put to work, read slavery, by the rich white industrialists who need them to do the manual labor. They keep the rich richer, the poor poorer. The head of the natives, Manu, hatches a plan to bring some of these riches to his people. They perform a voodoo ceremony, one that goes on so long none of the natives show up to work the next day, infuriating their bosses. Manu and his people build a giant airstrip, convinced that the great mysterious metal birds in the sky will bring them riches for them as well. A few nights pass, and amazingly, the sound of plane engines fill the air. As they approach, the white slavers see these are ghost planes bringing food, clothing, and appliances. Thus began the legend of the cargo cult. Ryan, what did you think of this one?
Probably my least favorite in the collection.
It just kind of sputters to a conclusion. It doesn't have like any real ending. It's like, oh, there are ghosts. The end. It's kind of like, that's it.
Yeah, and I think like you can there's a lot of rich storytelling material getting into the whole like islander like Zuvembe zombie cult and everything like that. But like this one doesn't do anything with it. It's just,
Yeah, I mean, part of the art, Jack Sparling, he's somebody maybe in 30 more years I'll really like his work, but I didn't like it as a kid and I don't like it now. I think it's kind of dull. The final image of the one white slaver where he looks like a little haunted, but like they don't get their comeuppance. Like it's just the voodoo cult brings the ghost planes and they bring food and supplies and again, even appliances like a Mixmaster and stuff. And the white slaves are just like, "Oh, I guess there are ghosts then." Like, that's it? Like, the white slavers didn't get like carved up and eaten or something? Like, they just kind of get away with it. So that it just sort of slides to an ending as opposed to having any sort of like real dramatic conclusion.
Yeah, our slaves are slightly better off than they were.
Woo!
But
yeah,
they're still our slaves. Like, wait, what?
Yeah, but now at least they can make smoothies. I mean, I don't know what the big deal is. And again, once again, white rich men are put upon. It's just, you know.
I know, really.
God, come on, Leo Dorfman.
Haven't we suffered enough? Speaking of, all right. The final story in this one, Death is My Mother by Leo Dorfstein, art by Tony Bisniga from Ghosts Number 3. In 1749, Sir Desmond rides his horse on the beach below Ballymore Castle in Ireland. Even though the sea caves on the beach always frightened him, Desmond decides to explore the caves. He slips on some seaweed and knocks himself unconscious. He awakens briefly, his head in the lap of a beautiful woman with mysterious eyes. Then he passes out again, and he wakes up alone. But as days go on, Sir Desmond returns to the caves looking for the strange woman. And one day he finds her. She tells him that her name is Lyra, and she comes from the sea. He thinks that's preposterous, but he doesn't really care. He just wants to lock that down. Soon, Desmond and Lyra are married, and soon thereafter, she bears him a son named Dennis. Years pass, and Desmond becomes a miserly landlord, neglecting his wife and child, who spend their time rowing a boat around the islands of Ballymore. Desmond and Lyra fight often. One day, he accidentally pushes her off the balcony. She falls into the sea. Her last words before the water swallow her up are a warning that Desmond will never get her child, that Dennis is hers. Lyra's body is never found, and Desmond tells Dennis to stay away from the water. Then Desmond returns to his life of counting money. Neglected and bored, Dennis sets out to sea on a tiny rowboat. A storm tosses him overboard, but before he drowns, the ghostly image of his mother appears. Lyra takes Dennis in her arms and drifts down into the water, saying she's taking him home at last. The boat is eventually found, but there is no natural sign of Dennis. As time passes, though, people walking on the beaches near Ballymore Castle claim to see the ghost of Lyra carrying her child. And if that doesn't make you believe in ghosts, I don't know what will.
You're hopeless, yeah. Again, this is another one where the art job, I think, is terrific. Right? Tony DeZuniga, you mentioned that panel that you want to take out of context. On page 2 of this story, that wavy panel... the then semi-conscious from the pain and shock. My head is resting on someone's lap, and I seem to feel the touch of a cool, slender hand on my brow. It's like little Aquaman-y, because it's got the woo-woo-woo-woo coming out. Yeah. And it's colored beautifully with, like, the magenta motion waves. Like, that's such a beautiful panel. Like, Zuniga really did a nice job on this. I love the woman. Like, she's very beautiful. Like, he really, right. like, conveys, like, the sex. She's in kind of, like, a Star Trek-y original yeah. series outfit where it's like as much flesh as exposed as possible. And I kind of like the landscapes that he draws when the guy goes into this cavern. It looks like Jupiter. Like it doesn't look like any cavern you've ever seen. And in fact, on that same page I mentioned, page 2, where he's leaning against like the rock, there's like a skull face in like two skull faces in the formation of the rock.
Yeah.
And you see the horse way in the background not coming in. The horse is like, screw this. I'm just staying out here. So, again, I like the story just fine, but I think DeZuniga really puts it across. Like, I'm not going to say it's like, you know, do I like it more than the Aparo job or the Jerry Grandinetti? Not necessarily, but he crushes this story. I think this is beautiful. I love the sea sprite, the way she comes out of the water. She's holding the baby. We're going home. Dennis, home. Yes, mother. Right. That looks great. And it looks, again, it looks really nice at a treasury size.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the coloring, too, just a lot of blues and greens yes. really capture, like, the yes. whole the seascape and everything like that, and especially in the storm and the rain towards the end, the last page. And just, yeah, there's just a lot of, like, really cool effects and everything like that. And just, like, the image of, like, the ghost woman on the boat, like, carrying her son and everything like that. Yeah, that image on the last page with we're going home, like, there's something – like that image, it's panel 2 of the last page, the way she's holding him, the way her like cloak like fits her, it's very squared off and kind of like box like and there's something, it reminds me of a Mike Mignola image from like a Hellboy comic or yes, something like that. Yes. That's what's coming to me. But yeah.
Well, he puts all the detail kind of at the top part of the body, and then it's yeah, just an abstract just shape at the bottom.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. Zuniga drew a lot of these stories involving, like, the sea and sailors. I think maybe either he requested it or they just figured he was good at it. And there's an issue of The Phantom Stranger during the Apparel run where he fills in for an issue, and that story is about, like, a phantom ship. So yeah. He must have just really enjoyed these kind of, like, nautical tales or something like that, because yeah, he did a great job. And it's a good one to go out on. Like, I'm glad that it goes out on a winner, because I think this is one of the better ones.
I do, too. I agree.
Yeah, and it does suggest you, too, will believe in ghosts. It tells you at the end there. So on the inside cover, it's a one little page black and white thing about famous haunted houses. There's a big image of a cat being strangled, which I absolutely do not like. But we do see Abe Lincoln, so calling Scott X, we got Abraham Lincoln there again, talking about that, of course, supposedly the ghost of Abraham Lincoln haunts the White House. We can only hope that he does and is currently – never mind.
I'm sure his ghost is probably more regretful of that than anybody right now. The things that he has probably seen.
Probably. I wish I'd stayed dead. So this famous haunted house. And then the back cover, of course, is a tabletop diorama, which you could cut out again and ruin your comic. And you could cut out the little ghosts and a pumpkin. And then you can also cut out a bat and a snake and put it in front of a haunted house. This one is one of my least favorite of their dioramas. I just think it's just not all that interesting visually. Ghosts didn't have like a host, right? Because the House of Mystery was Kane, and the House of Secrets was Abel, and the Witching Hour had the three ghosts. But ghosts was just ghosts. Like, it didn't have – so I guess they didn't have any, like, character, like, DC character to draw upon. So this looks kind of, like, generic a little.
They eventually did, but it was a long time. It was, like, issue 104 when they got a character named Squire Shade, who pretty much looked exactly like the Gentleman Ghost.
Oh, really? Wow, I didn't know that.
And he was the host until the book was canceled at 112. So, like, eight issues, it had a host. But then issue it was notable for – it had Dr. 13.
Right.
I think was introduced in issue Ghosts.
Everybody's favorite.
And was, like, the regular character that started, like, with issue 97, maybe? Like, around there?
Hard to believe. Yeah. Kids couldn't. Didn't, you know, flock to
yeah.
that.
Actually, I was looking up just some information on the book, and Paul Levitz, the publisher, said, like, Ghosts was never really well received by critics or fans, but for some reason it was disproportionately sold well. So I guess, I mean, the fact that it got 112 issues, they're like, yeah, it sold well, but nobody ever really knew why.
like the idea, just publishing it. It just goes out there and just, you know, somebody's buying this thing. So, I mean, yeah, 112 issues. Hey, I can't, Aquaman hasn't gotten to 112, so who am I to mock? You know, good job.
I got seven subscriptions for this book from somebody named Leo Dorfminowitz.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Leo Dorfman, his family, Mrs. Dorfman, all the little Dorfmans, stuff like that. I had to keep Dad employed to crank out these ghost stories. So I mean, overall, Ryan, like, what do you think of this as a collection? I'm going to go out on a limb and say this one is not as cohesive as The House of Mystery. I think The House of Mystery was, first of all, it's only like five stories, and it has Neil Adams and Bernie Wrightson, just a little more heft. But there's some good stuff here.
There is some good stuff in here, but a little goes a long way. And it's one of those things where when you get like these type of stories, there's so much repetition. The fact that there are two digests of Ghosts.
Yeah, I mean,
you'll be getting to those eventually too.
Many years from now.
Yeah. I think these are really fun stories, but maybe this is the type of story that you shouldn't read 13 of them in a row. Like, read a couple of them. I definitely think the variety of different type of horror stories that you get from the other things, like House of Mystery, House of Secrets, Unexpected. Like, I'm surprised one of those didn't get, or at least some of the ghost stories weren't folded into another kind of treasury that had different types of stories beyond just kind of like ghosts. Because, again, a ghost story is good, but once you've heard one of these stories, you kind of heard most of them. And they can still be good because there's a variety of ways to tell the story. But is this something that deserved a treasury? Well, some of these stories, as you point out, look really, really good in this format. So I wouldn't disprove that. I wouldn't say no to them. But, like, you know, why couldn't you have folded those stories into another kind of horror treasury that had the first Swamp Thing appearance in House of Secrets 92? You know, Swamp Thing never got a treasury, but we have this. I don't know.
So, yeah.
It's good, but it's not great.
Yes, I would say that. One other thing I'm kind of curious about is, of course, you know, we do all this research on Mike's Amazing World, and I've said many times before, every podcaster that does a comic book podcast should send money to Mike's Amazing World because it's an absolutely invaluable resource. But when I was doing research and I was looking up these issues of Ghosts that these stories are from, you know, you can scroll through the covers, just like click, 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 and you zip through them all. These covers, most of them by Nick Carty, are just beautiful. They're just gorgeous. And maybe they figured kids didn't want to pay for, they wanted a story. But like, I always wonder why when they reprint these things, they don't reprint the covers. Because to me, they're beautiful images. I would have loved to have seen them bigger, like a Nick Carty cover at a giant treasury size. But also, it would have filled up five pages. Like, that would have been one less story would have had to have. Now, maybe because the cover image doesn't match the story that they were going to reprint, and they maybe thought that was like discordant to have an image that doesn't follow the story, that, you know, whatever. But nevertheless, you look at these, like, a little while ago, DC was doing those books where it was like the cover to cover books, and it was like 100 great Superman covers and 100 great Batman covers. I bought those books because I just think they're art books.
I've got one of those.
And like, you look at these ghost covers, these House of Mystery covers, you're like, just do a book of that. Just do a book of DC horror covers. I would buy that for a hardcover now, let alone for a dollar in a treasury. So I always regret that they don't have these covers, because they're just stunning.
I have no idea, like, about this part of the business. Would there be anything to the fact of, like, they would have to pay Carty more, like residuals, to reprint the covers or something? Like, contract was different. I mean, they commissioned a new cover for him for this, so I can't imagine. But I just wonder if it was.
They were doing residuals back then. I don't think so. But you never know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Everybody was different. We're wrapping up here, and we're getting off topic a little. But I will say this, is because we're bringing up Nick Carty. The first time I met Nick Carty at the 1998 San Diego Comic Con, I got him to do it. I was so honored, because it was, oh my God, this is Nick Carty, and he was drawing an Aquaman sketch for me. And I asked him, I said, you know, Mr. Carty, I said, and he was, anybody who'd ever seen him, he was this big old guy with the, like, white hair, very avuncular, sweet kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, I said, did you ever get any kind of grief from DC that you did such unusual layouts? Because, of course, he did that, you know, the Black Manta cover where Aquaman is down at the bottom. And he did a lot of very unusually designed covers. Very atypical, very uncommercial. I said, did you ever get any grief for that? He goes, oh, no. He says, they were so desperate for people to do comics back then, we could do anything we wanted. I was like, wow, that was the golden age of comics, man. You can do what you wanted. So maybe, and Nick Carty, of course, came from the world of proper illustration. He did movie posters and he did like magazine illustrations. So you're right, Ryan. Maybe like he had a, you know, maybe he had like a sweetheart deal that, you know, Artie Saf didn't have or something. I don't know. But it, anyway, it just, if anybody wants to go through, go to Mike's Amazing World, look up Ghosts and just click through these covers. And it's just a treat for the eyes. They're just beautiful, beautiful images. So
actually, I think what it is if they had reprinted those covers, those are pages that Leo Dorfman didn't contribute to.
Leo Dorfman's like, hey, wait a minute. Is this the Dorfman treasury or is it not? What the hell is that? Okay, we kid Mr. Dorfman. We hope. I don't know if he's still, I assume he's not still alive, but you got to admire somebody who cranked the work out like he did. That's pretty remarkable. So
no, actually, I think he died actually fairly young too.
Oh, that's odd. Anyway, I hope he enjoyed his time writing comics, and I'm sure that he, you know, was able to anticipate that two nerds would be able to make fun of him 50 years later on a podcast. But anyway, no, there's a lot of good stuff here. I would argue, if you're in a store, you're in a convention, and you see a treasury like Ghosts is one of the ones you get later. I would definitely pick up Pastor Mystery first, but it's still, there's some good stuff in here, and it's a fun collection. And of course, it's perfect for Halloween. So Ryan, thank you for coming back on Treasury Cast to do this. We're making much like Chris Franklin is the king of Christmas. Ryan, you're becoming the king of Halloween here.
There you go. Thank you very much for having me. This was great to talk about these again.
All right. Awesome. Where can people find you on our network? What shows are you working on?
A number of shows. My new passion project, obviously, is Cheers Cast, where I go through every episode of my favorite TV show, Cheers. But, you know, you can still find me on Midnight, the podcasting hour, since we're talking about Halloween. That will come back. I've got a few episodes for that planned to come back before the year is out.
Yay.
And definitely go back and look at some of my older episodes. Rob has been on a few. Definitely check out episode 8, where Scott and I covered the Crimson Claw short story. But, yeah, and then, a few other projects, some ideas that I've got coming up for FW Presents, our anthology show. We'll see.
Very cool. Very cool. All right, everybody, stay tuned. We're going to run some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to do listener feedback.
Grab your bat microphone. It's time to start the show.
Check out the Bat Pod with your host, Bill Beer.
This was
an issue. Yes. Have you ever had a cucumber sandwich?
And his co-host, Joey Galvez.
I mean, I like it. You know, cucumber water. Have you ever had that? It's so refreshing.
Topic of the week.
I really love the Michael Keaton Batman, the Tim Burton Batman.
Thought you were going to mention Batman and Robin for a minute. You know, George Clooney had you at hello or
character spotlights.
The Condiment King was a guy named Buddy Standler, a former stand-up comedian, but, you know.
Stump your co-host segments.
Okay, where's your Batman card? Just go ahead and send that to me.
Sorry.
And we'll rip that up. Okay.
You can find the Batpod on thenerdylegion.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, Google Play, and we are now on Stitcher. The Batpod is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Network.
We're a crime-fighting collective. It's the Batpod.
What the blue bacon?
Jeff and Rick present Unpacking the Power of Power Pack,
where we journey through each issue of the most underrated Marvel series of the 80s while drinking beer,
analyzing awesome and amazing adolescent adventures, and absorbing alcohol.
We got kids with powers, we got villains with attitude,
we got superhero guests, like all of them from the Marvel Universe.
We have thematically appropriate beer reviews.
We have good jokes and bad song parodies.
One stop for all your Power Pack pod-pleasing procurements.
And we got alliteration.
Find Unpacking the Power of Power Pack wherever fine podcasts are played.
Costumes on. And we're back with listener feedback on episode 27 of Treasury Cast, which was the Doctor Strange Marvel Treasury Edition with guests Herman Lowe and Grant Richter. Ado Bosnar leads off. He says, sounds like a really great treasury. I was actually a bit surprised to learn about the content, as before I'd always thought this one was just reprinted a set of stories from the Lee Ditko years. Also, I was pleasantly surprised to learn that there are actually stories that delve into the past of the Ancient One. I'd never seen these, and I've hardly read any of the Doctor Strange stories that came out between the end of the Ditko run and the Engelhart material from the early 1970s. I've always been fond of the Ancient One, and I think a miniseries or even a 12-issue maxi-series should have been done about his past, i.e. his youth and training and his time as the Sorcerer Supreme, ideally written by Roger Stern. The cover, by the way, truly is one of the most iconic images of Doctor Strange ever drawn. One of the others, also by Brunner, is the cover to Doctor Strange No. 1 from 1974. Frank Brunner is certainly one of the definitive Doctor Strange artists, but Ditko is right up there for me, as are Marshall Rogers and Paul Smith. Also, I think Zom has an awesome look. It's horrific and a bit humorous at the same time. Leave it to the great Marie Severin, R.I.P., to come up with a design like that. Yeah, agree to everything there, Ado. I love the Marshall Rogers run of Doctor Strange. I love Paul Smith's and Ditko. Of course, Dr. Strange has been blessed with a lot of great artists. Martin Gray chimes in. He says, I never saw this in UK shops, but I've read all the material. That cover is truly a grabber. I must admit, I've forgotten Cleo's on there at all. It's as if Steve is levitating her in the manner of a stage musician. I miss Cleo. It's so sad that Marie Severin has died, but what great work those of us who never met her can remember her by. And wow, her design for the Living Tribunal remains peerless. I adore Gene Colan in anything. Horror, superheroes, romance, whatever he drew was a total treat. Agree there, Martin. Incidentally, Tilda Swinton is an American. She's exceedingly posh English, and she has a comics connection, and she has two children by the artist John Byrne. All right, it's a different artist, John Byrne. You had me there for a moment. I was like, wait, what? And then you got me, Martin, so good job there. Roger chimes in. This looks to me, says, great podcast, guys. Keep them coming. Thank you, Roger. Ward Hill Terry, Danny O'Neill wrote Doctor Strange. Wow, great analysis, gents. I liked how Grant continually referred to Doctor Strange as Steven. Regarding your comparisons of Marvel and DC treasuries at the time, I believe that Roy Thomas was the editor of the Marvel treasuries, and Roy had always shown himself to be a scrupulous librarian, researcher, and archivist. He would have been extraordinarily canny and shrewd as to which stories would be included. Yeah, I think that's probably right, Ward Hill. Although, as far as I know, on the DC side, E. Nielsen Bridwell handled a lot of the treasures, and he was no slouch in the archiving department. But yeah, I think just presentation-wise, Marvel had the edge on DC. Chris Franklin, my pal, says, great episode, and this sounds like a fantastic collection. I've always been intrigued by that cover. Brunner is vastly underrated, in my opinion. I think he could have been Marvel's Neil Adams had he been able to, or wanted, crank out more work. I know Adams worked for Marvel, too, but I always think of him as mostly a DC guy. I also agree Marvel did a better job at packaging their treasuries. The mid-70s were kind of a fallow period for DC, and as much as I love the characters, a lot of the better talent was over at Marvel at this time. Once Adams and Nick Carty walked away from monthly work, DC really took a hit. Herman and Grant were great guests, and I'm definitely going to check out their show. I hope you do, Chris. It's a great show. Into the Weird, it's a terrific show, so you'll enjoy it. Gothos Mansion says, while I like him, Doctor Strange isn't a character I collect, so the reason this is in my collection is, as a 70s baby, I just can't resist a treasury. Me neither. The only other Doctor Strange solo book I have is the Ditko Omnibus. Since I'm not that familiar with the character, I can attest this is a good introduction. Rob, I think you're right that the earliest of the Marvel treasures are good primers on the characters. My only complaint with the Doctor Strange treasury, and I have this with several Marvels, is presenting only one part of a multi-part story. If Marvel felt they had to do that, at least present the final part with the flashback recap scenes intact, which Marvel did in Spider-Man and Hulk treasuries. I also thought the inclusion of the masked look for Strange was a bit unusual, since I think it was pretty short-lived and had already been abandoned by the time of the treasury. My first exposure to it was in an old Hulk reprint in Marvel Superheroes, long after Strange had abandoned the blue face in current continuity. I remember not liking the look because it wasn't how he looked in the Defenders. And as for Marvel vs. DC, I think DC Superman and Batman treasuries did feature a theme to tie the selected stories together. Now, it may have been a theme I didn't enjoy, Shudder, Superman's Adventures with Children, Shudder, but there are themes nonetheless. Where DC's treasuries come up short is that they kept cutting the page count, meaning some only featured a couple of stories. Since Marvel kept their reprint treasuries up to 80 pages, they seemed more epic, like they were giving the readers more. I understand DC was trying to keep the price down, and treasuries had gone up from $1.50 to $2 by the time I started to get them. I did come across the Dollar JLA treasury at a store that apparently didn't return their stock, since it predated when I began collecting. Fortunately, I had an understanding mom that was glad I was just eager to read and didn't complain about spending extra money on the treasuries. Yes, lucky there. I had the same thing with my dad. I was very fortunate. Luke Jack and Eddie says, hey guys, just listened to this episode and very much enjoyed it. I have never read a lot of Doctor Strange, and I don't have any Treasury Edition comics. Oh, Luke. So this was very informative and entertaining for me. All the crazy interdimensional shenanigans sounds like fun. My LCS has a bunch of treasury for sale on a rack right near the register, and I am tempted every time. This one has just jumped onto my look for list. Thanks for the great show. Thank you, Luke, and you'll have to let us know if you've picked up some of those treasuries. I think you should. You could, if you can get them at a decent price, it's a good idea. So thanks, everybody, for the comments. Of course, you can always leave comments on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And now over to social media. I have to thank those of you who retweeted the show over on Twitter. Again, it helps get the show noticed. So thanks to 108 Sage, Supermates Pod, Rolled Spine, Robert Magaha 55, Trucker Talk, Black Vulcan 69, Matt Flower 1, Lee Asif, Herm Germ, Xenozoic Files, Vinyl Turban, Justice Trek, Maxo Romero, It's Plastic Man, Factory Mirror, Hat Trek, Adam Thanos Pod, BTO and Bat Book, Zoom Mukinuri, Gurthon, The Mind of Scott X, Randy S07, Sean42AZ, Bazinga Cal, Scott Slangward. So again, thanks everybody. Really helps get the show noticed when you retweet it on Twitter. And so that's going to do it for this episode of Treasury Cast. Big thanks to Ryan Daly for coming back and doing another Halloween episode with me. It was a lot of fun. Marvel never did any Halloween-related ones, so not sure what we're going to do next year, but we'll have to figure something out. And again, thanks to Herman Lowe and for Grant Richter for coming on episode 27 of Doctor Strange Treasury, and thanks everybody for the great feedback. So that is going to do it for this episode of Treasury Cast. Have a happy and safe Halloween, everybody. And until the next episode, go big or go home.
From out of their hiding places, goblins step and laugh. And then...